Hi there, you're listening to the Redaction Politics podcast, our final episode of 2020, this strange year. This episode, I'm joined by Mason Kwa, our reporter, and James Moles, our co-editor. And I'm, of course, Declan Carey, our reporter and podcast host. First of all, in the news, it's just been announced by Boris Johnson, who said, with a heavy heart, London and many parts of the southeast of England are being placed in tier four restrictions. James, Mason, what are your reactions to this announcement tonight?
To be honest, I'm not surprised you have a heavy heart if it's made of stone.
Yeah, my own response is just like, this is something that had to happen and it was put off as long as possible, which gives it the greatest amount of emotional impact to all the people who already have plans set or people who are making commitments for the holidays. I don't condone anyone breaking the rules, obviously, but there are many better ways that this could have been broken than the way that it was done.
Yes, just to give some context to our international viewers, in England at the moment, this is England specifically rather than the whole of the UK, though there are similar systems in the other home nations. In England, we have a tier system. Until literally today, there were three tiers. So tier one, medium alert, that's the lowest. Tier two, high alert. Tier three, very high alert, which was where many urban areas in the country were at until today, when the Prime Minister announced there'll be a new extra strong tier four brought in just before Christmas, and plans to ease lockdown restrictions over Christmas were scrapped in the tier four areas and restricted just to Christmas Day itself in the other three tiers.
The odd thing is, just a few days ago, the Prime Minister said it would be inhumane to cancel Christmas, and today the Prime Minister cancelled Christmas.
Well,
many people have mentioned this once or twice on Twitter, as you might imagine.
As you might imagine, yes. In fact, one such person was Nigel Farage, who tweeted, Christmas cancelled, thank you China.
He pops up every episode. Which
I'll just copy Racism Watchdog into that one. He's been popping up his head where it's most unwelcome, which is more or less wherever he goes.
Yeah, setting aside Nigel Farage, who, you know, very fun to punch at, but I think, like, there needs to be some serious criticisms, like, not just of how the news is broken, but also just of how, I guess, ambiguous in many ways the tier system has been. I remember all the way back at the start of the year, since this is our 2020 retrospective, we began with a five-tiered system, and I think that only got scrapped because people compared it to the spice meter at Nando's and the realization that, you know, England was getting dangerously close from medium spicy to very spicy, and that didn't look good for the government.
Yeah.
I genuinely thought you were about to say Spice Girls tier for a second there, and I'm thinking posh spice tier, that's where all the rich people who the rules just work for them and they have their second country homes can go, and then... Yeah. I don't know where ginger spice would be.
No. Well, it'll certainly be an interesting week ahead. Anyway, less than a week before Christmas, it's all kicked off, hasn't it? So I don't know. I think there's going to be a bit of a fallout from this. And where's Labour? Like, where is Keir Starmer? Does anyone know?
To be fair to him, he did bring the British Medical Journal's advice out before the Commons, which was to say, we're sleepwalking into a disaster with these restrictions eased before Christmas. And of course the Prime Minister just turned around to him and said, wants to cancel Christmas, and 3 days later, what happened?
Yeah. I think, you know, like, we need to sort of call a bit more attention to just how unprecedented it is that, you know, like, broadly partisan medical journals have gone very far out of their way to criticize just how badly this crisis has been mismanaged in the country. This isn't something that we see on the regular. And that's why I think it should be that much more shocking that it took several days for this advice to be heeded.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I've always said they're following the science, aren't they? But I don't know. It doesn't seem to quite be that straightforward to me, because it seems that when you listen to the press conferences, the science has been for quite a while pretty concerning. So why were they saying for such a long time that we're going to have a Christmas, we're going to have this certain amount of 5 days where people can go home and be with their families, and then all of a sudden, less than a week before, then cancel it? It just seems so unorganized.
Optics. I mean, You know, they were willing to accept a few thousand extra excess deaths if it meant people didn't complain about losing Christmas. And I think that's a terrible decision that they were willing to make and that they only pulled back on because of the backlash.
Are the voters going to forgive Boris Johnson for this sudden U-turn? What are the next few opinion polls going to look like? I'm curious to see that. I reckon we could be seeing Labour with as much as a 5-point lead in the current coming weeks.
It's difficult to say. We can look at the U.S. mirror to sort of get an idea of how similar things have played out. Trump was largely voted out because of how badly he mishandled the coronavirus crisis. He repeatedly got slammed for statements like "it'll be gone in a few months." When the weather changes, it'll just die out. And we have the same rhetoric here, wrapped up in a British flag. Oh, it'll be gone for Christmas because Christmas is a magical time of year where pandemics go away for the night.
You know, those coronavirus particles will be popping up to have a game of football with the NHS staff, won't they?
Exactly.
Yes, indeed. Well, let's see what happens over the next few days. It's certainly going to be a very interesting but stressful time as well for lots of people. I mean, the topic of this episode, the main thing we're going to do is we're going to try and somehow describe this year. I mean, God, what a year it's been.
Hardest not to address Declan and my inadvertent wardrobe collaboration.
Mason didn't quite get the memo today, I feel.
Team Grey Turtlenecks. That's what it's all about.
I mean, look, I've watched enough dramas to know that the character wearing the turtleneck is always a secret agent. They always betray the main characters.
But who for?
And who's the main character?
That's the question.
Well, I'm not wearing a grey turtleneck.
This is going to be really odd for podcast listeners, though. It'll probably make no sense.
If this is your first Redaction Politics podcast episode, to be honest, I don't know what to tell you.
I mean, if it's your first
to the previous
episode,
ones.
Then click the subscribe button below this video.
Yeah.
Remember to hit the bell so that you get reminded about future videos.
I mean,
anyway, on to the topic of the day.
Yeah, I mean, let's go from one you know, confusing, really, you know, opaque topic, which nobody understands, which is the tiered system. And let's go to a very, very clear thing that everybody understands, which is Brexit. We all understand Brexit, right?
Yes. Yeah. It happened once when the referendum first came back. It happened again at the start of the year when we left the EU. And it's happening again at the end of the year. That's my understanding of it.
Tell you what, I was just for a bit of fun. I was in London on the day Brexit happened, and I popped down to Parliament Square where that massive celebration was going on. And you know, that was the day, of course, when the first confirmed COVID cases landed in the UK, if my memory serves. I think it was that same day. It was certainly roughly around that time. So I'm not saying there's a link. But no, I'm not really. But yeah, I mean, it was interesting, an interesting experience being at that and talking to a few people there. Because one thing they were flying there was the US flag. And I was talking to people like saying, this is Britain, isn't it? What's the US flag doing there? And they're all saying, oh, yes, it's very much like Trump, isn't it? And I'm saying, what do you think of all these rumors that they're going to sell the NHS off to Donald Trump after this? Oh, no, it won't happen.
So there were Brexiteers there saying, let's reclaim our sovereignty, and then planting a big American flag in London. Basically.
Correct.
Okay, and how do we think that's working out? Do we have our sovereignty back? Do we have it now? What do you think?
Do we have to answer this question? Were we not an independent nation before? This has been debunked so many times. Yeah.
Look, we're allowed to have our Overlord or Cubic or even Square Bananas now, and there's nothing that the EU can do to stop us.
That should be the first thing I'll be buying in January.
And the second thing, you know, we're now allowed to have stronger than regulation vacuum cleaners, which were banned by the EU for their negative environmental impact.
And we're allowed to go and make trade deals with other countries that almost exactly resemble the ones we would have had with the EU. Wait. But
We're also allowed to go around hat in hand to all of the old Commonwealth nations that hate us.
Oh, yes.
Hey, remember that time you beat us at football? Cricket?
Oh, yes, the Indians, we used to rule them. They'll love it if we pop around there and they're going to say, hey, do you want a free trade deal?
Yes, yeah, so of course, Brexit was the big thing that happened in January, of course, at the start of the year. But before a lot of the maybe key events of this year happened. And as Mason said, it feels like it's happened, what, two or three times, but it's still not happened. But it's still got to wait till next, what, 1st of January. And then there's also something in July. It's just, yeah, a complete.
I remember last year when they were saying, oh, Brexit is the biggest constitutional crisis to face us since the Second World War. This is the biggest crisis since the war, and now we're looking back.
Yeah, I'm reading a book about Brexit at the moment, actually.
Oh, yeah? Which one?
It sounds awful, doesn't it? But it's actually quite interesting. Middle England by Jonathan Coe. And it's quite weird reading it back, because even though it's not that long ago, it's hard to look at it and not feel like it's another time, almost. It just, you know, pre-2016 just feels like another age now when you read it back and read about the events.
Yeah, Brexit has taken so long to actually happen and continue to happen that there have been multiple waves of books, documentaries, and historical reenactments attributed to it.
Brexit the musical. We've got to see this.
Oh, no.
Brexit on ice.
Oh, no. God, I hope not.
Andrew Lloyd Webber brings you Brexit and the Technicolor.
It has to be a pantomime, doesn't it? Sure, if anything.
Yeah. All these immigrants are coming to take your jobs. Oh, no, they aren't. Oh, yes, they are. But for all my criticisms of him, it's always very fun watching James O'Brien talking to Brexiteer gammons who call in. And they'll say, okay, we can take back control of our laws. And the question you'll always put to them is, so which law are you looking forward to no longer having to follow? And hardly any of them will ever give a straight answer.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there was so much propaganda that was put out, right? Like the EU has 20,000 regulations about how fluffy your pillow is allowed to be. There's a reason why everyone remembers the banana thing. Because there are a rather limited number of cases where EU regulations have actually interfered on a person's everyday life and livelihood. And bananas are apparently the biggest one we were able to make a big fuss about.
Yeah, and who knew so many...
I don't even like bananas, to be honest.
I mean, they're a good source of potassium.
This is true.
Yeah, I mean, that's come about, isn't it, really? Like, literally, when did anybody care so much about fish? Apart from this year. Now we suddenly become a nation of fish lovers? Like, what's happened there?
I mean, we fought wars over fishing rights more than a few times. We burned the White House over fishing rights in the War of 1812.
This is what it's going to come to.
Yeah.
Yes,
That's just going to be the parting words, isn't it? So long. And thanks for all the fish.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the big stories of the year in January. That certainly kicked off, and it's still rumbling on, isn't it, really? It's one of those stories that is never going to end. I wonder if it will ever end in our lifetime, because even in theory, in January, we're supposed to leave. But it's never going to end, is it? We're going to be talking about this for so many years. And, oh, God, it does, isn't it, talk? And, I mean, it's ironic, isn't it? We're talking about it, but it is a dull topic, isn't it?
Yeah, picture the scene now. You know, the year is 20XX. Britain as we know it no longer exists, but we continue every year to send out a delegation to the EU requesting an extension of the negotiating period. Nobody quite remembers what this means, but who would argue with a tradition that is so firmly rooted in our culture?
Well, yes.
Brexit Day. When is Brexit Day? In June, isn't it, sometime?
Brexit should join the credit crunch with another list of, you know, important political consequences that sound like breakfast cereals.
Yes, indeed. Let's move forward a little bit at the time then. So obviously Brexit happened in January, early in the month. I mean, probably the biggest story of this year, came about in March, a story which is still going on now, and that's when coronavirus, COVID-19, whatever we want to call it, started to come to Europe and mass lockdowns came. Of course, it was still present before then, in even the year before, in December. I remember reading news reports about it in China. But it really felt like March, didn't it? It was the time when lockdowns started happening and it got really, really serious over here.
Well, it happened so quickly. That was one of the things about it. I remember even sort of 2 weeks, 10 days even before the lockdown happened here, thinking this might still blow over. This might just turn into another swine flu that'll everyone's worried about for ages and then just peters out.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the streets being packed enough on Chinese New Year. Nobody was worried about it then. I remember hanging out with a group of friends in person for like the last time this year, just a few days before the lockdown came around. Like no one saw it as a serious issue until suddenly it was. And the thing is that, you know, the World Health Organization had been raising it as an issue, even though they hadn't, you know, hit the pandemic button. And we just sort of waited in that game of chicken.
Well, I think, I was guilty of this myself. Thinking, okay, we heard this all before. We heard it with burn flu. We heard it with swine flu. We heard it with E. coli. We heard it with Ebola. They all said it was going to be this deadly pandemic that was going to completely destroy humanity. It didn't happen then. Surely this is just going to be this again.
Yeah, I mean, bird flu didn't have the power of 5G backing it up.
Well, this is true.
Yeah, it almost was a bit blasé, wasn't it? I agree with you, James. I was the same. I didn't really take it seriously until it got to around February time. And then it really did kick off, didn't it? I mean,
the moment
now, can you remember what it was like on the day when you heard that lockdown was announced? Can you remember what that was like?
The day for me where I thought, okay, this is getting serious, was when Italy announced its lockdown. Before then, I remember, you know, Wuhan locked down and a load of people just thought, okay, well, that's just China, isn't it? That's how they roll. But then when suddenly it happens in a Western democracy, suddenly it feels a bit scarier, a bit close to home. And I remember even after, you know, Italy locked down, Spain locked down, everyone over here saying, well, we can just appeal to the great British common sense, can't we? We don't need to force a lockdown. Yeah, that worked really well, didn't it?
We're an island. How's the virus going to get here?
You know, people just ride the fish over here. That's how it happens.
Yeah, and of course we all came together and nobody definitely didn't buy all of the toilet paper and pasta in supermarkets because we wouldn't do that.
There's the problem. We all came together and that's how the virus spreads.
Why toilet paper though? Okay, I could think of some wrong answers to that. Why toilet paper?
Right. Like some people posted meme threads on Twitter about people hoarding toilet paper and then everyone started scrambling to make sure that they were able to get some before somebody else hoarded it.
I just don't get toilet paper though. Like I can, a little part of me can understand pasta because it, you know, right, it's a food which you know, you can keep in your cupboard for a long time and you can cook a lot with it and it's easy and it's fast. Okay, fair enough, I kind of get that. If there's a pandemic and, you know, we've never lived through this before, maybe that, I can understand that. But toilet paper, I don't get it. I don't get why people would scramble to pick up that of all other things.
Like I say, I could think of some wrong answers to that one, but... we'll keep this podcast strictly PG-13. In all seriousness though, I remember at the time of the lockdown talking to people and thinking a lot of people worry, like, okay, I have food allergies, where am I going to get the foods I need? I need life-saving medicines that I need to get on a regular basis. How am I going to get those in a lockdown? As much as we laugh about toilet paper, there were some very real concerns like that.
Yeah,
because and given how quickly it all happened, it was sometimes difficult to get answers.
Like, I mean, your example of people needing to get medications, that this is also an issue that Britain should have been especially prepared for, because we were meant to be stockpiling like our medications that we wouldn't be able to easily access after Brexit. Britain should have been better prepared than any other nation on the continent for a pandemic, because we were supposed to be preparing for something close to a no deal Brexit, and it turned out that none of those preparations were adequately in place because we got hit a lot harder than other European countries.
And it raises the question, what would have happened if we had had a no deal Brexit?
Yeah, well, right for.
Wait for the next episode. We'll find out.
Oh, yes.
That's an early plug. I like it. Yeah, I mean.
You know, I will have my Mad Max look on by then. After all, it's an Australia style deal. Sorry, I'll leave.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, I remember with COVID as well, it was just, I never thought I would live through something like this. You know, I always felt that was something which you read about in a book or, you know, or something you saw in a TV series. And some of them were scarily similar, weren't they? Like, I'm watching a TV series at the moment on Netflix, and there's a pandemic episode in that, and it's very, very similar, actually, to what happened with COVID. And it's kind of funny looking at that now, you know, from having experienced this. Yeah, did you ever think you would live through something like this, like a world, you know, global pandemic?
Well, I mean, we all entertained that possibility several times before, like I say, when I remember I was about 12 or 13 when bird flu was a scare, and I remember being really scared by it at that age, and reading all the Daily Mail headlines and thinking, you know, what were they saying at the time? Hundreds of thousands of people were going to die.
For me, that big scare was SARS, because, you know, the big scary part about that one was that it seemed to be more lethal in people and young people with healthy immune systems, and it was such a medical anomaly at the time. But yeah, I think nobody expects to live through these kinds of times, but we're not the first generation to do so. You know, the big example, obviously, Spanish flu killed millions of people, caused massive changes in how people had to behave in public, massive campaigns to get people to, you know, for example, stop spitting in the streets because spitting spreads Spanish. The other big example, 1816, the year without a summer. I believe that was caused by, you know, volcanic eruptions, other side of the world, big ash cloud, massive changes to the climate across Europe. Lots of people starved in that year because we weren't prepared for crops to just suddenly stop growing for basically an entire year. These mass anomalies have hit us before, and, you know, compared to Spanish and the year without a summer, this is at least a bit milder, and we have access to Netflix in the meantime.
But, as a scientist, how did it feel for you watching lots of people say it doesn't exist, and not wearing masks and not following guidelines?
I mean, I don't advocate for social Darwinism, so I think it's bad that they're doing this. Like anti-science rhetoric has been on the rise for a long time. It's something that we've always had to contend with, and it's just more visible with the way that people have responded to COVID. It's not like these same people weren't protesting against climate action.
And of course, it's a good thing that, you know, we had somebody so keen on science in the White House.
Look, when he said to inject bleach, he was obviously being ironic.
Oh, God.
This is also the guy who tweeted back in 2012, was it, that global warming is a Chinese hoax. So how surprised should we be, as depressing as it is?
Yeah, God, I really remember the inject bleach thing, though. God, how bad was that?
I remember just thinking at the time, look, there are people who went out and torched masts over the 5G conspiracy.
Yeah.
What's going to happen now that the President of the United States is saying...
Yeah, I mean, he kind of brushed it off as a joke, didn't he, later? But, God, I mean, what a thing to say.
The priceless moment there was the expression on the face of his science advisor as he was saying it.
Yeah, I mean, that's not an easy gig, is it?
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it does feel that people are increasingly being led about by, you know, basically somebody, like, vaguely remembering a tweet about how an experimental scientific process works, and then trying to extrapolate that into a full understanding of the subject. You know, that is, in my opinion, where the inject bleach thing came from. That's not something that you pulled spontaneously from your mind. That's something you get from vaguely skimming a headline and then badly extrapolating what it means.
Yes.
And then you can just imagine there'll be some headline like that and Trump will retweet it with "so true" in all caps.
Yeah, and now, I mean, they've started putting those things on, haven't they, underneath his tweets that his claim is disputed. Imagine if it existed then.
Well, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? But
every time that had been done previously, it was decried as authoritarian overreach. I remember the Singaporean government had been criticized for basically instituting a law that allowed them to attach basically an equivalent message to information that they deemed was contrary to the facts. And everyone was saying, you know, oh, this is so Orwellian. I think it really puts a lot of things in perspective. And I think Singapore does have a lot of problems, but, like, Christ.
It does raise some interesting questions about how we approach social media. Because, for example, if you work in the media, if you're a journalist and you publish misinformation like that, in this country, if you printed wrong information, you'd have IPSO on your back. That's the Independent Press Standards Organization. And it raised the question, should the same standards apply to what people post publicly on social media? Maybe, maybe not. That's an interesting debate to be had.
But to what extent can you even regulate that, since social media is broadly anonymized?
Hmm.
And, you know, even when there have been attempts to sort of do this, like there have been with Donald Trump's Twitter account, like, how many people see that messaging and just write it off as, this is obviously QAnon. The deep state is trying to suppress our glorious leader and prevent him from reaching his true glory after he won the election.
I think we're getting onto the election a bit later, though. Let's leave that thread hanging.
Yeah.
Another election that happened in the first half of this year, of course, was the replacement of one Mr. Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the Labour Party. Three contenders were the eventual winner, Keir Starmer. There was Rebecca Long Bailey, who was widely seen as the continuity Corbyn candidate, the one closely aligned to him ideologically, and Lisa Nandy. Keir Starmer's victory wasn't much of a surprise, was it? He was widely seen as the front runner all the way through.
Yeah, I mean, he had the experience, didn't he? He had a lot of experience in Labour. He was had a lot of experience in law too. I think the question
he was
is
the when, director of public prosecutions.
Yeah, I think the question is when Labour, when obviously Corbyn announced that he was stepping down as leader, it was a long time. There was that kind of transition period, wasn't there, where we were waiting to see who would be elected leader. And obviously, I think the question was, with Keir Starmer, what was Labour moving back into? I don't think many people really knew. I think it was clearly, it wasn't as, you know, as left-wing as Corbyn was. That was obvious. Hmm. But exactly what Keir Starmer represents, we didn't know
well,
then.
I mean,
do we really know now?
Is it a back as well?
What do you mean by that?
Well, you said, where's Keir Starmer going to take us back to? I mean, we could be looking at something completely new. And that's what we still don't know. Keir Starmer has been quite evasive in trying to pin himself down politically. And it's also looking through his record, quite hard to do that. He's only been an MP since 2015. He's hardly had a long stretch of time in the Commons to define himself politically. And a lot of that's been when he's been Shadow Brexit Secretary. Almost all of his tenure has been in the Commons has been since the Brexit referendum happened.
I mean, if you look at Starmer, undoubtedly, when we referred to our episode on optics, when we talked about looking the part as a politician, undoubtedly he looks the part. You know, he's got the
suit, sure,
the haircut, and it kind of.
I do have very serious hair envy on Keir Starmer. I'm not gonna lie.
It kind of throws me back to images of, you know, David Cameron, like, looking young, looking, you know, smart in his suit, and if that does appeal to a certain type of voters, whereas Corbyn was obviously. Never really looked the part, did he?
Shall we say?
Yeah, he did get better though, didn't he? He did start wearing a suit more often, and he looked a bit smarter.
Yeah, I mean, as I said in that episode, Corbyn was, you know, was strong on policy in a lot of areas, but yeah, he was not a good example of how to do optics. In fact, if anything, he's probably the example of how not to do it.
Yeah, I mean, what do we make of Keir Starmer then so far? How, you know, he's been there for a while now, since March. Do we think he's doing all right so far? What do you make of it?
I mean, I would take the somewhat critical stance. It feels like he's just led around by whatever the opinion polls say should be his stance. And I don't think that's something that actually draws in the passionate people that are needed to win elections.
I largely agree with that, to be honest. It's shown by when he's abstained on some key votes, such as the Spy Cops Bill and the Overseas Operation Bill, both of which were widely criticised by the left of the party, and a lot of left-wing Labour MPs broke the whip to vote against it. Keir Starmer is very actively refusing to have himself pinned down. And how well that plays in the long term remains to be seen. Obviously, there's still, you know, 2024 is when the next general election is. He has plenty of time to define himself, but, you know, if you don't define
that old maxim,
what's that old maxim? If you don't define yourself, your opponents will do it for you. I can't remember who said that. I'm sure someone will tell me in the comments, but he ought to pay heed to that, is my personal hot take.
Do you think Keir Starmer will still be leader by then? We've spoken about perhaps Boris Johnson might not be. Is there a chance that Labour could have its own revolution?
I doubt it. Oh. Really doubt it. I don't think the left of the party is in a strong enough position to mount a leadership challenge. Bear in mind, when that happened to Corbyn back in 2016, most of the parliamentary party was against Corbyn. They had the weight to be able to do that. Even though the membership got behind Corbyn in the end, they were able to put through that no confidence motion that, you know, and Corbyn very nearly was toppled. He might not have made the ballot in that leadership election if it hadn't been ruled that he automatically went on it as the incumbent leader. The left of the party doesn't have that right now. And to be honest, I think a lot of the left of the party, and I say this as somebody who positions themselves on the Labour left, you know, are smart enough to realise it's not actually in our interests either to be toppling Starmer.
Mm. Yeah. And,
even if he's not ideal.
Any type of infighting makes the entire party look weak.
Exactly.
Like, I think Starmer should at least work a bit harder to build a broad church rather than sort of feeding the infighting that's been going on under him. And I think that would be the best move to sort of show a viable alternative to the Conservatives.
The left of the Labour Party right now needs to be focusing on trying to get policy concessions out of Starmer rather than being getting caught in this infighting over, it's largely been over the EHRC report now.
I mean, one other event which was really defining at the start of this year, on the first half of this year, was the death of George Floyd. Mm-hmm. This was a African American who died whilst being arrested in the United States. How much of a defining moment was that?
That video got very widely shared. Obviously, it's absolutely horrifying to watch. And you always think, remember, with these videos that do emerge like this, these are just the ones that got filmed.
But I think it did also demonstrate just like the sort of dual realities that, you know, the different American parties live in, right? Because we've seen people watch the video of George Floyd being murdered and then look up and ask, well, why didn't he just do as the police said? I think, you know, it was a very important event. Like, it defined a large part of the year for American politics. At the same time, you know, like, I don't know if there's any threshold of evidence that will convince the entire nation to back that kind of political change that the movement is demanding for.
Of course, what we've seen a lot of right-wingers come out and do is say, oh, Black Lives Matter is run by Marxists, it's all critical race theory, and they will throw out all these words that, you know, a lot of them clearly don't know what they actually mean. They just words that sound scary that they don't like. They're all socialists, they're all Marxists, critical race theory, postmodernism.
Don't forget postmodernism, yeah.
Postmodernism, yeah. Got to get that one.
I'm surprised that they haven't yet managed to track down the real identity of the CEO of Antifa. Because, yeah, like, they're making very specific accusations of what is, you know, a largely decentralized movement. You can't accuse BLM of being a Marxist movement any more than you can claim British, you know, any more than you can claim that the British identity is rooted in, I don't know, fighting the Germans or the French.
It was sort of, I guess, spectacular to see how Black Lives Matter affected so many different parts of the world.
Yes.
And it showed that that message was clearly not just felt in the United States, but it was something that was going on in all countries. And it spread to, you know, it spread to sports, you know, in England, in our sports matches now, players take the knee to show solidarity with that. It just spread absolutely everywhere. And that was spectacular to see that happening and so many people getting behind that. Yeah, just to see people united over something and be passionate about something was incredible. But as you say, there were people who were against that. There were people who were very critical of it. So although it was a movement which divided,
and they had to find those ways to be critical about it in roundabout ways, like saying they're Marxists, because they don't want to be coming out and directly saying we're against a pro-black rights protest movement that's criticizing police violence. I mean, you'll get some, dare I say it, not very bright people who'll come out and say white lives matter, or does it, some of them say all lives matter, and then get into arguments about which they should be saying. But a lot of the more tactically minded reactionaries, shall we say, do find these sort of other ways of getting to criticize Black Lives Matter without actually having to get to the root of what Black Lives Matter is actually about.
Okay. We're going to, one of the last things that happened in the first half of the year then, which I really want to get your thoughts on, was the whole issue of Edward Colston and his stats in Bristol. So Edward Colston was a gentleman from Bristol, and he owned slaves, obviously, in historical record.
He was a slave trader.
He had a statue in Bristol, which was pulled down. People in Bristol decided they didn't want it up anymore, and they decided to take it down forcefully, and it was thrown in the river, and it was all over social media.
And this was during a Black Lives Matter protest.
Lots of people were saying, you know, this is a turning point. It's gonna change a lot of the country. Funnily enough, you know, I actually personally didn't know about Edward Colston before they pulled down the statue. Yeah, how significant was that moment this year?
I think that remains to be seen. Obviously, it did open up a debate about public monuments, which did lead to the long-standing campaign to have the statue of the famous colonialist Cecil Rhodes removed at Oriel College, Oxford. It did create a debate for a while, but from where I'm sitting, it seems to have petered out a bit. Maybe it'll flare up again at some point. But I think it was glad that people started to acknowledge some of the true legacies of the history of the British Empire, which, you know, from what I saw on that most reliable of places that is Twitter, some people seem to be learning something, others didn't. And there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, in the same way that, you know, like there are people in America shouting that white lives matter, that there were people at these riots complaining about how the Irish were also used as slaves. It's,
I think, whataboutery is the word you're looking for there.
At least whataboutery implies some level of actual equivalency, right?
There is that too.
Yeah. Like there are very significant differences that are probably too big to talk about here between, you know, indentured servitude and chattel slavery.
I mean, I'd love to do an entire episode of the podcast on this. As an ancient history graduate, a large part of my final year of my degree was studying the history of slavery, both in the ancient world and beyond. So I'd love to have a separate podcast episode completely devoted to that, the history of that and its implications today. Let's make it happen.
For me, just thinking about this moment, it was so important, I think, for Britain that, you know, I feel like many people in Britain, we have these, you know, long traditions. And I think people often just say, you know, why are things like they are? Oh, well, because they've always been like that. And I think this was a moment which really challenged that. And it's probably one of the first times I ever saw that people said, well, it doesn't need to be like this and we can take that statue down. You know, it'd been there for so long and people just almost didn't care because it was just accepted, or it was part of empire. Slavery was part of the empire. But now it almost seemed like back then people said, no, we need to reevaluate who we are and what type of statues we put up. And that was a real striking moment.
And the counter argument that always gets put out, which for the record I don't agree with, is that they're all part of history. You can't change the past. Why do you need to take them down? Surely you're erasing history by taking these statues down. But I mean, let me put out a slight thought experiment, shall we? We should never forget the Holocaust. Let's go and build a statue of Hitler in the front yard, shall we? That's not how these statues work. They're there to glorify history.
Well, not in the front yard, right? We're going for the equivalency here. It should be in a public space.
Well, of course.
Not even on private land.
These statues are there to glorify history. They're not there as a remembrance of history. After all, loads of these statues are there completely devoid of context. They'll just say who it was. They won't tell you who they were at all. That's not how you remember history. How do you learn anything from that?
Yeah, and as we were saying earlier, like, I think a large number of people didn't even know who these people were until their statues got taken down. But yeah, I don't think, I mean, you know, I think I might have brought this up when we discussed it previously, but this isn't the first time that the nation has seen rioting over a controversial statue. But I think that this one is at least a bit more, will hopefully be better remembered than the Brown Dog riots. That were about animal vivisection and their use in like medical experimentation. But, you know, when we went around 50 years later and took all histories, the accounts were all mixed together. There was at least one account claiming that the protests were trying to shut down a local hospital. So, there needs to be an effort to record these events in a way that will translate over through history.
Okay, on that note, let's bring part one to a close. Stick around for part two, where we're gonna look at the second half of the strange year that was 2020. So from this episode, thank you for listening. I've been Declan Carey, and I was joined by James Moles, our co-editor, and Mason Kwa, our reporter, and we'll see you very much soon next time.
And for an easy way to get access to that second part, click the little button below the video with a bell icon on it.